Good morning. Yes, so Chris invited me here this morning, particularly to share about the work that Tear Fund is doing in the Middle East. So for those who don't know Tear Fund, I'm not going to give a big introduction to all we do, because as I was speaking to Mary earlier, we do an awful, awful lot. So I'm just going to give you a snapshot. Because the reality is we can't escape what's happening in the Middle East. It's just always in the news. As we heard about this morning, as was prayed, thank you so much for those prayers. The Middle East is a place in real need still. And I went to visit Lebanon a few weeks back, and what I saw there was broken homes, broken communities, and I met many, many refugees. And as I was preparing, I just was struck, what is a refugee? A refugee is someone in need of refuge. They're in need of safety. They're in need of protection. And this week, you may have seen over 200 faith leaders. In fact, I'm just going to... Sorry, I'm this... Isn't mine. I think it's my big ears or something.
Keep going.
So this week you may have read, there was this quote put out. Desperate people who have been driven out of their homes by war are being forced to make dangerous journeys in search of sanctuary. The sheer scale of the refugee crisis has the capacity to paralyze us. Not sure if you saw that statement put out this week. And if I think back to the last 5 years, when I think back to this Middle East crisis that's just been growing and growing, I think there's certain pictures that we can't escape that's still on our mind's eye. Those of Aylin Kurdi, the four-year-old boy who was washed up on that Turkish beach. That image just kind of punctured our public consciousness. Or just 2 months ago, I think it was, that image of the boy who was, you know, drawn out of the rubble in Aleppo, covered in debris, covered in blood. And there's these images that we've had on the news that kind of still remain on our eyes. Because the reality is that many people throughout the Middle East have been killed. But many more millions have been forced from their homes. Families who are torn apart by this war. I met people who said, my brother's in Turkey, my sister's in Iraq, I'm in here in Lebanon. You know, just that war has separated them by many hundreds of miles. And the numbers are staggering. The numbers are huge. It's the largest movement of people since World War II. You know, the largest amount of people at the moment just moving, trying to find safety since World War II. In Syria alone, 50% of the population have been forced from their homes. So that's 11 million people have had to flee for safety. Perhaps to their own country, elsewhere, or others to across borders, like into Lebanon. And the other 50%, it's not as if they've got it easy. Because suddenly your town has doubled the population it may have had. So that means that's double the population who are in need of food, in need of water, who are squatting in the unfinished homes, who are looking for work, who are going to take less pay than you would otherwise have yourself. It makes the whole economy, the whole relationships really hard. In Lebanon, a very small country, which is where I went, it's the size of the southwest of England, with 4 million people. There's now 1.5 million refugees on top of that. So that's one in four people there are refugees. That's like 20 million people coming to the UK. I mean, that is just huge. We can't understand some of these numbers. So as I said this week, the sheer scale of the refugee crisis has the capacity to paralyze us. But I just want to spend the next 20 minutes trying to not let that be the case this morning. And the poor, the refugee, the person in need, that is a theme that you will find throughout the Bible. It's a theme, and again, as was prayed, Jesus was a refugee himself. He was forced from his home looking for safety in Egypt. In Isaiah, it says, "Hide the fugitives, do not betray the refugees, let the Moabite fugitives stay with you, be their shelter, hide from the destroyer." God's chosen people, they were refugees, they were exiles for many years themselves. So what does he say to them? He says, remember them, look out for them. This is your heritage, this is your story as well. In 1 John, we're told, "Let us not love with words or speech, but with actions and in truth." And these are the words that rang true for me when I spent time with Christians and spent time with churches in Lebanon as they were learning to reach out with a practical action, but motivated by Christ's love for them. And at Tear Fund, you may never have heard of us, but we would describe ourselves as following Jesus where the need is greatest. And there's a few things in that are so critical. We're not taking Jesus. We believe Jesus, he is already in those darkest places. That Jesus' light is already there, and he's saying, come on, church, come to this place, find me here. Bring that life, that fullness to this place of greatest need. And that might look like all sorts of different scenarios. I've been to visit communities at risk of being trafficked. I've been to visit communities where they're recovering from the genocide in Rwanda. But this was a whole different look when I went to the Middle East. Because suddenly you've got this urgent, pressing need. You've got people forced from their home. Because 5 years ago, people who are now living in these tents, they were living lives not too dissimilar from myself. The people that I met that I'm going to tell you about, they had a home. It was quite a nice home. Not just one bedroom. They had homes and bedrooms for their children. They would have had their own businesses. They would have actually been to school, a good school. They would have been able to get to school safely. They would have gone on holiday. People I met, they went on holiday to Lebanon because they had the money to do so. And that was the bit that made it really hard. I've met people who live in desperate poverty, but that's all they've ever known. And that is really, really bad, let me say. But suddenly, if you've got a comfortable life and that's forced from you, that's like this whole other scenario that is just really different. And so we went with our team. So we're working here in Lebanon through Christian and church partners. So we're working through an organization called Heart for Lebanon. And we went with them to this camp. And if you think of 1.5 million people who are refugees in Lebanon, this looks pretty small. But this is actually the biggest refugee camp in Lebanon, in the Bekaa Valley. Because Lebanon has this long history of refugees from 1948, 1968, who have fled to their country, who started living in camps, and then they just never left. And so they became towns, became cities. And so there's this long legacy of the Lebanese kind of taking in large volumes of refugees and then they're never leaving. So they've been really strict and they say, no, we're not letting these big camps that you might see in Jordan, 50,000, 60,000 people. So here is 169 tents, maybe 200 families. And that's the biggest in the Bekaa Valley. And the Bekaa Valley is just 15 minutes drive to, you can't see it. Oh, no, you can. Just those mountains there, a bit of a hazy day. That's Syria. So really close to Syria there. So we turn up and we're with the team and they're all Lebanese people. They're not like people like myself going in from elsewhere. They're all Lebanese Christians motivated by verses like 1 John 3:18. And they get out of their truck and they set up a table. And I just stand there and I'm watching them as these refugee families come up because they're there for their monthly distribution. And the first thing that really struck me was how they shook every person's hand. They looked them in the eye. They called them by their name and they just talked to them. They shared life with them. This wasn't just this kind of Tesco Express, beep, beep, next, 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 just development, aid, get it out, get it out. This is relationships. These are Christians who are compelled to shake their hand, hear their story. They're there once a month giving out these food parcels, but they're there twice other, you know, in between, who are going and just spending time with people, going from home to home, from tent to tent. Just hearing their story, you know, maybe sharing their faith if they ask, praying with them, building relationships, showing them dignity, people who have very, very little. And so Ali came up. So Ali's going to pop up on the screen with his family. And I saw Ali. He collected this big bag of food. So in the bag, it cost £45 for a month's food. You got like rice, pasta. You got dried vegetables or beans, pulses, you've got cooking oil, toilet roll, just like really basic stuff that they need. And Ali comes and he collects it. And I think he actually puts it on a wheelbarrow to take back. And there's this rusty wheelbarrow, and I'll tell you why in a moment. And then he invites us back to his home. So we go to his home, and his home's just this kind of wooden kind of panels with some tarpaulin strapped over the top. And we sit down on the hard floor, drinking some very sweet tea. And he just starts telling us his story. And he starts telling me about how he's from Aleppo. You know, we all know Aleppo. We've heard it on the news so many times. And he just is telling me his story, that he's from Aleppo, that suddenly one day rockets just started firing down on their home, on their community. So he runs with his family, with his children. They get together, they flee. They go out into the countryside for a couple of days, and then when the fighting's over, they come back. Because they thought maybe that was it. It's just a small, this was like 4 or 5 years ago. Maybe that was it, just a skirmish. But then like a week later, happens again. More rockets, they flee. There's chaos all around them. And they do this 5 times, and on the last time, they're running away from this rocket attack. And he's with his family. And there's, as you'd imagine, just cars and people. And his 7-year-old daughter just gets taken out by a truck. And they're there just having to deal with that, losing their daughter. And so they leave. They bury, they grieve, and they just have to leave with whatever they have on their backs, their clothes. They come with very little to find sanctuary, to find safety. So they come to Lebanon. And he's been now in Lebanon with his family about 3 years. They're just outside their home there, their tent. And he just starts talking to me because they never expected to be here for that long. The Lebanese, they only expected them to be there for like 3-4 months. And now years have gone by and they're still not able to return home. And he's not allowed to work. So many of them, as you'd expect, work illegally, you know, laboring, whatever they can find, but often abused, often not paid what they said they're going to be paid. But because of the conditions, he's got a dreadfully bad back, so his children have to go out. So his 10-year-old son goes out into the field to collect potatoes, because they're staying on this farmer's land, so that's part of the deal that, yeah, you go and work for me while you pay your rent. And it's just really hard, because I've been to other scenarios, I've been to other situations where I've sat with communities who have very little, and I've been able to say, so what's next? I was in Uganda last year, and I was working where we work through local churches, and then there's it kind of to release the potential that's already in that community. And you can ask the question, what's next? And this flood of, well, I'm going to try this, I'm going to try this, I'm going to give this a go, I'm going to try starting my own business, comes. Because suddenly, through the work of the church that we do in that context, they've come alive with ideas. You may have heard about this through Change a Nation, and if you've been at New Wine, we've shared about this. But here, I can't ask that question, but I do. So I say, what's next? And they're like, well, we just have to wait. We're just waiting. Each month, we're dependent on the food that we can bring as tier funds, because otherwise they have nothing. They can't work, they can't leave, and it's just really, really hard. And so that's his story. He tells me, just as we're leaving, I said, oh, so how long have you been in this tent? I said, oh, we've been here just over a year. Our first one collapsed. I was like, oh, that's very good. How come it collapsed? And we're there on a 40-degree day. It is really hot. And he says, oh, it collapsed because of 2 feet of snow. And I'm like, what? And in the winter, they get 2 feet of snow. And we're there in the summer in 40 degrees of heat. And they're there in this tent the whole year round. That's why they need our support. That's why we need to go through our church partners, through our Christian staff, and reach these places. I think stories are the best thing I can do, so I just want to tell you about Mahmoud. He's from Homs. I'm standing outside. You can see, for the eagle-eyed amongst you, there's a motorbike. So as he starts telling me his story, he tells me that he used to run a motorbike garage. You know, again, he was a businessman when he was from Homs. And he came here about 3 years ago. He came here with his family. And he just starts talking to me about his family. And they've got a very similar scenario of coming with nothing but what they could carry. And they've been there now for some time. So we sit. And in that time, he's now got his first grandchild. And so she wasn't there at the time. But he starts telling me about his first grandchild. And then I ask about the rest of his family. And again, we support them through monthly food packages. And he tells me about his son. And this is when it really hit home for me. It was when he said, yeah, my son got married last year, here in the tent, here in where we are. And you don't know me, but I got married last year. And it was about the same time that this guy got married. And that's when it really hit me. Because there's something about, there's so much out of their control. There's so much that they can't control. But it was almost like, we're just going to carry on with what we can have. We can start a family. We can have children. We can get married. And that was a bit where I just broke down. I just started crying in this person's home because I realized that actually their story is so much like mine. They had a business, they had a home, they got married, but it's all been taken from them. And so we're working in the Bekaa Valley, supporting families like Mahmoud's, like Ali's, with these monthly food packages. And we went along to one of the church services of one of our partners there. And I walked in and, you know, it was quite different. There's many people, kind of many women wearing headscarves. And then, you know, as happens at my church, it started empty. And then by the third song, we're a little bit fuller. So similar problems there as well. And then I'm just chatting to the church leader at the end. And I'm like, just tell me about your church. And he just says, well, we started as a church plant in 2003. I'm just adding this one in. This isn't on my notes, so don't worry about the picture. We started as a church plant in 2003 with six people in my flat. So I'm like, okay, I'm part of a church plant. 15 of us, I know the story. But then in 2010, we bought our own building. There were 60 of us. So we bought our own building. And we were growing as a church. And then he said, and now there's over 300 of us. And we have four services a day. We have one for Kurdish refugees. We have one for Syrian refugees. And we have two others. And it's just everyone comes along. And we're not segregating people. Because suddenly their church has just grown. Because they are reaching out in this practical love. Like that passage I read, it's words, it's not just words, it's that practical love as Christians. They're reaching out to their community, who are Muslims, who are Yazidis, who are Christians. It doesn't matter what faith they're from. And actually, people are asking questions. And it's just amazing to see people of new faith and converts who have come to the church, and the church is growing, but because the church has reached out to them. And the church then didn't like shove a message there. They just kind of built that trust. And then people started saying, so why are you doing this? Mahmoud said to me, because I said to him, you know, why, do you get support from anyone else? You know, is it that Tear Fund come one day, World Vision go another day, the UN come on Wednesday? No, we're the only partner working in this camp. We're the only people that they receive input from. And what he actually said is, it's the Christians who I can rely upon. Lots of other people have said they're going to come back. And we wait for them to come back and they didn't turn up. But it's the Christians who always come back when they say they will. And this is a Muslim man saying that. And for me, I was just like, wow, what a good witness that is to this man. I'm going to tell you one more story. I love the stories. So this is someone completely different. This is a Syrian church leader called Thomas. And he lives in Syria. So he happened to be in Lebanon for a couple of days, but he lives in Syria. And for him, in his area where they're from, suddenly about 5 years ago, just people started to arrive. When they're forced from their homes, people just started to arrive. And he hadn't got any kind of development training. He hadn't done any kind of work with the UN before. He was a church leader. So what do? They'd start giving out from what they had. From what little they had already, they were like, yeah, we're going to give this out, money for people to help pay with rent, food, whatever we can do. And now Tear Fund, we've identified people like Thomas and other church leaders in Syria, not just Lebanon and Iraq around, but within Syria. And we're now working through them, supporting, in this case, over 600 families each month with a food parcel. And Thomas told me about this widow who arrived in his community, who's from Homs. Two of her sons were drafted into the army and she had not heard from them in over 2 years. And her three younger children were not able to work and she had cancer. And so quite simply now, the church, Thomas, has been able to provide her with a monthly food parcel and provide her with this specialist medicine that she needs to be able to live. So that's why he was in Lebanon. They can get food and other supplies in Syria, but he travels to Lebanon each week to pick up medicine to be able to distribute for those in need within Syria itself. And he has a team of 16 volunteers who are just learning to do this. And Tear Fund, we've said, look, we just want to support you and what you're doing. And they're just learning to do it. And we're helping them do that. And they've given over 800 crutches away, supported over 14,000 medical prescriptions in the last few years. They're just doing life-saving work within Syria. So how do I tie this all together? Kathleen, who leads our work, she's based in Erbil in Iraq. She leads our work in the Middle East. She describes their strategy as this: life, recovery, hope. We are saving lives through people like Thomas. That is the first step of what we're doing. That there are people who would otherwise be dead, but they're not. It's as simple as that. Because the church is there. The church is there, meeting people's immediate needs, saving lives. We're providing recovery for people like Mahmoud and people like Ali, people who've had to flee, people who are now living far from home, to communities who've suddenly got this surge of a population, double, triple the amount of people who should be using that water supply. We're providing recovery there. But we're also providing, not providing, that's what Jesus does. We're restoring hope. That's what we sang earlier, restoring hope. And on the final day, we were visiting some work in Beirut. Within the city, about a third of these 1.5 million refugees are within Beirut, within kind of slum communities, you know, as bad as I've seen in India and other places, you know, very poor conditions. And we visited the centre that we're now supporting. And the centre is providing trauma counselling to children. And I get talking, it wasn't term time when we're there, so we just meet the teachers, but I get talking about what they're doing there. And they said, well, we're doing all sorts, but one of the things, we just get them to draw, you know, art therapy, and draw what's ever on their mind. And she tells me about this 9-year-old boy who drew a memory of watching two men be beheaded and then being told to dig that man's grave. And that image just was stuck in his mind, stuck. So we're there, releasing, restoring hope for children like him. And it was a real privilege to be there. And I started with this quote, "The sheer scale of the refugee crisis has the capacity to paralyze us." And when I was in Lebanon, I was with our CEO, and some of you, there was an email that went out this week that I know Mary read, and others may have read it as well. I was on that trip, and I was with some supporters as well. Margaret, who's from Northern Ireland, I was with. Just on the final day, we're talking, and we're just trying to make sense of this, because I've only got more questions, genuinely. I've only got more questions as a result of going. And she just says the same thing. "I've only got more questions. The situation is more complex than I could ever understand it to be. But I just have to put that to one side. And actually, it's quite simple. That these people are in desperate need of our support. If you look on the news, you'll get confused. But you just need to know that these people are in desperate need of support." And so today, you have an opportunity to respond. And I want to offer that to you. Each day, our partners are here in Lebanon, places like this where I was, and Syria, supporting the vital, urgent need of those refugee families. And what this lady's grabbing there, one of these monthly food parcels, costs £45, and that's going to help her and her family for a month. But this pack isn't just about the food. What this pack is, this is like a bridge that we get to bring good news to the poor. We get to restore hope to the hopeless, because this is a bridge to them. And so I want to ask you to give. You're going to be able to give in a couple of weeks' time, as Chris said, in your Thanksgiving service. And that cash is going to come to Tear Fund. And thank you so much for those gifts. But I also want to ask, could you give regularly? Because if you could give £10 a month over the course of this year, you're going to provide for three families for their needs. Because they need our support this month. And unfortunately, they're going to need it next month. And I want to tell you that they won't need it again after that. But from what I've seen, I think they might. So they're going to need it the month after that. And so you've all got a form on your seat. I'd love you to consider what your response might be. I'd love you to consider giving regularly. This is a form that's normally used for something else. So don't worry about the Connected Church element. If you want to find out more, even, there's just a way that you can just say, look, I want to pray. I want to find out more. Just let me know. Follow up, because I'm not sure today. Some of you are in a position to decide to give regularly. Some of you really want to pray about it. And I know that. So that's when I was with Thomas. I said to him as we were closing, look, Christians in the UK are going to say, how can we pray? And this is what he said. Pray for peace and security, and that God would give people boldness to witness, and that they would be able to persevere until the resurrection day. Pray that global leaders would get a clear perspective, and that refugees would be seen as people with rights and dignity. So in a moment, I'm going to close in prayer. But I just want to first offer just 30 seconds for you to consider what your response might be.